You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team, led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is proud to be a part of the Airwave Media family, home of such shows as Fork in the Road, Small Things Often, and Therapist Uncensored. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Hey there, Monster Talkers. Today we're going to be talking about disenchantment. Our guest will explain it in deeper terms, but from its original conception to the present, the idea that the world has undergone a demagicking is widely popular. You hear it in the complaints about dogmatic materialism of science, about the loss of spirituality's cultural significance, in the way that paranormal enthusiasts talk about seeking proof that there's more to the world than just the material. We've talked about it in terms of seeking the numinous. In his book, The Myth of Disenchantment, author Jason Ananda Josephson Storm makes a clear, cogent, and expansive case that despite the ubiquity of these concepts, that the world is not, and never has been, disenchanted. On the one hand, we need only look around. Churches, temples, ghost clubs, monster hunters, New Age shops, crystal healers, witches' remedies, they're everywhere. No one is scuttling around in alleys trying to hide their dying magical ideas from the paradigm police. But even if there's no monolithic global trend towards secularism and materialism, the idea of disenchantment still sits out there to be reacted to. And people surely do. So today we will be talking about disenchantment. And like a lot of the things that we discuss here, it needn't literally be true to have a huge influence on the way that we think and act.
Monster Talk.
Today we welcome Jason Ananda Josephson Storm. Jason is a professor of religious studies at Williams College in Massachusetts. He earned his master's degree from Harvard University and his PhD from Stanford University. He's had visiting positions at Princeton University, the Universität Ruhr, and the Universität Leipzig in Germany, and the École Française d'Extrême Orient in France, and at Harvard. His academic work on Japan led to the book The Invention of Religion in Japan, and in 2017, he wrote the book that we're going to talk about today, The Myth of Disenchantment: Magic, Modernity, and the Birth of the Human Sciences. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Yeah,
very excited.
So, yeah, Jason, we want to talk about your book. And so your book is about disenchantment, but what do you mean exactly by that term?
In this particular book, I'm reacting to a very famous and influential text in critical theory, It is a work called Dialectic der Aufklärung, The Dialectic of Enlightenment, by a couple of thinkers, Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno. And this is a really informative and centrally influential text in the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory. And they use this phrase, disenchantment, and they use it to describe the end of belief in myth, the end of belief in magic or occult powers, the extirpation of animism, and the end of belief in spirits. And they associate it with a kind of rupture that is either enlightenment or science or modernity. Readers have interpreted their ruptural moment differently. But that was the book I was reacting against or trying to figure out. It's a book I have a love-hate relationship with. And they, in turn, were getting this notion of disenchantment of and Zauberung, literally demagicking, from a very famous German sociologist that I imagine many of your listeners will have heard of, even if they haven't heard of Horkheimer and Adorno, that is to say Max Weber, who was probably one of the founding figures in the history of sociology, very influential in both Germany and the United States and all over the globe. And Weber had described this, something called the Entzauberung der Welt, the disenchantment or the demagicking of the world as one of the central features of our current moment. But actually, if you keep tracing it back, as I do in the book, and look at different variants of it, it doesn't always mean the same thing, but it's actually an old trope of magic itself. Folklorists like J.G. Frazier, end up using it, but it actually appears in their folkloric materials even before they use it as a term of their own theory. All the way from Chaucer, the wife of Bath, which says, you know, once the land was full of fairies, but no one can see them anymore. The fairies are always departing. They're always vanishing. And many a book of magic of people who believe in magic begins with, you know, magic is otherwise lost from its high day, you know, high point, and is only preserved in this text. So in a way, this myth, the myth of disenchantment in a less sociologically robust way or less philosophically robust way goes far back. Into the European folkloric history, basically. Yeah.
When we started putting this interview together, one of the things I ran into that was challenging is your ideas and research overlap so many different topics we've talked about on the show and that I've been and Karen have been looking into for years that it's like, oh, how do we narrow this down? So I feel like in my heart, we're probably going to have you back and talk about some different things.
And I can underscore this too, because I'm still waking up a little bit. So I'll get more fluid as we go on. But yeah, basically, it's the idea, disenchantment is the idea that people don't believe in myth, magic, or spirits anymore. And it turns out that this is false, actually.
Yes. You made a devastating case. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I started your book, and like within the first couple of chapters, I was like, oh, well, that's a myth I need to let go of. But the book keeps going. There's a lot more to go there. And I guess one thing we should say is how is the idea now popularly conceived compared to the way it was meant by Weber and these other academics? Like, it feels like that changed over time.
Well, I think that the biggest shift maybe is, it changes over time and it's definitely different even in different thinkers. So, you know, there's a version of this myth in Freud, for instance, which he connects it to a particular history of psychology or, you know, but in popular ways, I think the phrase disenchantment in English is also heavily associated with an emotional state. So we say, I felt a little disenchanted when I realized that this flavor of ice cream was not as yummy as I expected, or I don't know, or like, you know, or I used to believe in this politician and then I became disenchanted when I realized what an awful person he was or something.
Yep.
But that adds a level of emotional inflection, which, while not completely absent, is not the main point of emphasis or even the central way that that term functions in languages like German, where the sort of theory and the sociology and much of the earlier scholarship generates from. So instead of what was originally a kind of more historical description, people they believed had stopped in the Western European world, at least, had stopped believing in spirits and magic, or spirits of occult powers and magic. It became this idea in the contemporary context of a kind of melancholy that you associate it within a popular audience. So the world is disenchanted and we're sad about that, or something like that.
Your book touches on some really big ideas like modernity and secularization and the Enlightenment. Can you briefly describe what these mean in simple terms? I know that's a big ask.
Yeah, so one of the myths that I'm interested in undercutting, and this is perhaps the most radical, is that there was a certain rupture when everything changed and everybody suddenly got rational. Usually this is a story that's told about the West, and it's a mobile story that is told about different time periods. So it's either like, oh, the Greeks discovered rationalism and then everybody was all rational, or it's the Protestant Reformation happened and everybody suddenly became rational. Or more often today, it's in the Enlightenment, a particular historical moment, arguably in continental history, mostly associated with Britain and France, happened and everybody suddenly got rational. Or maybe it's even later, people want to say it was, you know, the dawn of the 20th century and suddenly everybody got rational, et cetera. Mm. None of these is a very good characterization of history. It's just broadly speaking, as historical sociology, it's false. And second, the oddity is that it's a mobile myth that people have articulated, then went in search of a period from which they could generate their own myth. So it's like they decided that it must have been a rupture because, and it was in the context of colonialism, that the West was just, you know, so much more rational than everybody else, that they assumed that then they went back into their own European history to imagine a different moment when it had all changed. And this is where language of revolution or language of enlightenment or something like that.
Well, so I really enjoyed the book. And again, you made many of these cases so explicitly. And most of the characters in the book I was already familiar. There was a few historical figures who I don't know their work. But largely one of the things that kept coming up was the fact that people that we sort of set up as paragons of science or rationalism aren't. Like they turn out to be complicated. Like they're not the simple sort of monolithic figures. And I don't know why we do this, but it seems like in every field we sort of build these saints that sort of represent, you know, the best of whatever. And it turns out they always have feet of clay. I can you address that a little bit? I mean, so how does sort of explaining the complexity of actual human behavior versus these paragon ideas. How is this furthering your claim that disenchantment is mythical?
Yeah, so I'll add two pieces to the narrative of the book just for your listeners that will make sense of what I'm about to say, which is, so, okay, you might ask, when did we get, so if disenchantment is a myth, and this idea of modernity is the ruptural moment, or the Enlightenment is the ruptural moment when this disenchantment first happened, if those are both myths, when were those myths created? Who invented them? In what context? And a good part of the book is identifying those figures. And then the surprise is that a lot of the myths come from the 19th century. And the 19th century was a period that, you know, we know as historians, was full of occultism, spiritualist revivals, and theosophy. So it's not, if you were going to like pick a time period that was a time period of not much happening in terms of paranormal belief or whatever, you wouldn't pick the 19th century, right? But the 19th century is when this particular myth formulated. And then the archival work that I did in the book was going back into the lives of these figures, these paragons in different kinds of disciplines, and trying to figure out in their personal lives whether they had had contact with any of these occult, spiritualist, or what have you movements of the period. And not to, to spoil spoilers for the book, it turns out that a lot of people were in more or less dialogue with, or at least open to, much more of these things than we would imagine looking at it from our particular historical moment and vantage. And I don't think of it so much as recognizing that these paragons are imperfect, but just recognizing that humans in general are, you know, we're only so rational, basically, and that this isn't something that is either historically determinate or, let's say, culturally determinate. It's not that there's, you know, Europe is rational and Asia is irrational, nor is it the case that people are rational today and people were irrational in the past. I mean, again, we can focus on how we're defining rationality. But what I want to say is also that then it turns out that that the past is, yeah, messy, as I think you're right. It's complicated. And so things that today to us look silly to believe in, or might look silly to believe in, weren't necessarily silly to believe in, whether we're talking about fairies and Chaucer's day or talking about, you know, something, you know, much more current. There's a strong tendency to back project whatever we take to be the current view of the world and notion of rationality, and then hold people in the past up to that standard. And so I think, part of this complexification, I don't think it makes any of these paragons any less paragons, but it also humanizes them, maybe. Yeah, and it should remind us to be humble ourselves, because probably some of the stuff that we take for granted as being an obvious and rational thing to believe, it might turn out to be the case that in a future generation, they're like, wow, you know, they were so strange to think this was rational or to take this to be part of their ontology or what have you.
So, Jason, if disenchantment is a myth, then what's really happening when religious or mystical groups say that they're trying to regain influence or power in society? And does belief in disenchantment still motivate these communities in some way?
Yeah, exactly. Your second point is right on it. So the myth of disenchantment, I want to argue, is a real myth, which means that there are some people who actually believe in it, and it has two side effects. One, it has the biggest side effect that it has is actually it produces a backlash against disenchantment and contributes to people's attempt to, quote unquote, re-enchant the world as an answer to the disenchantment that they presume they're fighting against. So I can say even in a little more sociological detail why different groups talk past each other. But to take a step back, I think you're exactly right that it's a real myth. And then the second thing that it does is it does in certain sectors actually drive a kind of policing. It functions. So I want to say that I'm not making the claim that nobody has ever tried to disenchant anything, but just that broadly by the numbers, it hasn't worked. Right. And so, you know, the sociological data. I'm just brought this slide up because people are always like, whoa, when I cite it. But, you know, according to, you know, 2005 survey data, 73% of Americans believe in the paranormal. So it's like three quarters of Americans. And according to something, data based on survey data that I had to piece together, but based on similar time period, 83.3% of Americans believe in the reality of either angels, demons, or ghosts. So we live in a world, and if you look at Europe, the numbers are a little bit down, but not hugely down. And if you look at more recent data in the United States around the even paranormal experiences, I have a survey from 2022, it's incomparable. It's about 70%. So, it's, you know, roughly three quarters or between, you know, a percent of Americans. And the thing that I do want to differentiate, though, is disenchantment from secularization, which are not the same thing. So, right. One of the things that I will grant, and I think is very much the case, is that institutional religion has lost authority. But the presupposition, you know, the Anglican Church, for instance, may have, the Church of England may have a certain kind of historical legitimacy, but very, very few people who are deeply invested in the way that they would have been 200 years ago, for instance. Mm-hmm. Or in the United States, denominational Protestant and Catholic traditions, you know, are less powerful and have less cultural hegemony than they might have had in previous decades. But actually, it's people in the past, even sociologists in Weber's line, thought that when you had secularization, people left institutional religion for a kind of atheistic rationality. But that's not actually what happens. What happens is, and we can see this because we can compare data between, for instance, parts of Western Europe where, like the Czech Republic, where atheism is through the roof. What actually happens is as people leave institutional religion, they become more likely, not less likely, to believe in things like ghosts and spirits and UFOs and what have you. So, and then the other key piece is they don't all believe in the same things. You actually have belief fragmentation. So the people who believe in UFOs often think that the people who believe in demons are silly, and the evangelicals who are deeply invested in demons think that UFOs are all really demons, and so the people who think that they're UFOs are silly or maybe even damned. So what we've actually seen is we have seen historical change, and I'm not denying historical change. I'm actually arguing for it. It's just what we've seen is belief fragmentation, and that's not the same thing as a new kind of rationality becoming dominant, and it's compatible with or various kinds of secularization. Yeah,
right. Very interesting.
It is now. Obviously, in the context of our show, we do a lot of coverage of paranormal concepts, cryptozoological concepts, stuff we've lately been calling weird shitology.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah. But I think one of these recurring themes in the paranormal or in alternative forms of history is this idea of a golden age, that things used to be better in the past. Have you given much thought into disenchantment as an oppositional narrative to, you know, like that we would be in a progressively moving away from magical thinking versus if we could just get back to the glory of magical thinking? Like these seem like they're conceptual opposites in some way, but they both have been around a while now.
Yeah, and I think of the myth of disenchantment as different versions of that same thing. I mean, you both have triumphant and melancholy folks on either side of the narrative, and you have it on both versions of that narrative. So you have some people who think that things are getting disenchanted and that's a bad thing, or you have people thinking, oh, we've actually, you know, Steven Pinker, for instance, who I had dinner with and had an argument about some of this stuff with, but things are always getting better. But one thing he did agree with me about is that people are not actually getting more rational, even though on a basic psychology level. As a psychologist, he could not make that argument. As a kind of funny sort of pop historian, he would then tell a narrative about how everything's getting better. But some things are getting better. It's just, you know, not increasing rationality. There's that version, but there's also melancholy versions of it. And you have melancholy golden ages when we were supposed to be rational and melancholy golden ages when we were supposed to be all magical thinkers. And both of those narratives are false. Insofar as there's a limit to my sociological data, obviously, because, surveying this stuff is fairly recent. From what little evidence of popular belief before basically the printing press is almost non-existent, but what little bits we can reconstruct suggest that there were skeptics in the Middle Ages, just as there were deeply felt, you know, believers. In fact, even that belief was more unsettled in medieval Europe than a narrative of a unified Orthodox Europe, et cetera. And also, I think that there's a fundamental mistake, too, that some folks make, which is to presume, to back project what we could call like a Harry Potter notion of magic on people who believed in magic in the pre-modern period. Basically, you know, this Harry Potter magic is basically like you say some words and you wave your hands and stuff floats around or whatever, or you wave some magic wand and, you know, you can turn something into a duck or whatever. That's not what... Right. Medievals who believed in magic believed in. In point of fact, it's, you know, notions of natural magic or demonic magic or angelic magic were complex, but they weren't so much, but they fit in lockstep with what was for a time, not anymore, but for a time, the dominant form of natural philosophy, so we could say science, and theology in the period. So, you know, they emerge from those assumptions.
Well, so this leads perfectly into my next question. I wanted to ask you about specifically the 19th century. There was a surge in organized magical practices in places like England and France. Could you tell us a bit about what was happening during this time that led to this interest in magic?
Yeah. So there are a number of significant, let's say, waypoints on the way to that. But I'll highlight some of them, but we could push them or nuance them or go further back even. So, I mean, I think the biggest shift is that at the beginning of the 19th century, so one level, the biggest shift is at the beginning of the 19th century, we have the rise of the spiritualist movement. Not very far from where I am here in Western Mass. I'm in my office at the moment. We have... there was the Fox sisters, basically, who's I'll assume that your listeners are pretty familiar with
it. Our listeners better be familiar with the spiritualist movement at this point.
So the mid-19th century sees the rise of the spiritualist movement, and the mid-19th century also sees the rise of a narrative of a disconnect between religion and science. The idea that science and religion are in conflict, the so-called conflict thesis, is basically a product of... with some nuancing, Victorian England. And then these myths are created about a conflict between religion and science that are back projected. So, for instance, the idea that Columbus discovered that the world was round and that a bunch of superstitious people thought that the world was flat. Actually, we have more flat earthers now than we had ever given in the Middle Ages, right? The people past historically thought that the world was round whenever they thought of it. I mean, the Greeks knew that. So the 19th century, we have a conflict narrative, and we have the rise of spiritualism. And the third thing that happens is that basically there's some shifts in, you know, of loss of institutional religion and the rise of an interest in what we would call the underside of religion, esoteric movements. And I'm thinking of people like Eliphas Lévi, who was a very influential French former priest who got into art and then into drawing, into the tarot.
His work is baphomazing.
Yeah, exactly. Good fun. Yeah. So these things kind of come together by the middle of the 19th century. So you start to have, you know, and Lévi was in contact with the spiritualist movement and he's reacting to that, out to French analogs of it. And so, you know, you have to have, like, people have this idea that religion and science are conflict and that in conflict, And then often they're trying to provide a solution to that conflict by creating scientific religions, for instance. And spiritualism often called itself a science, the spiritualist science, or Eliphas Levi called what he was doing an occult science. It's a similar kind of vocabulary. But also you have the loosening of institutional norms and the bubbling back forth of ideas about magic. And so, and then the biggest last step to what we, to the landscape that, that comes to define us today, and I know y'all have talked about this in the podcast, is that in the 1870s, emerging out of the spiritualist movement concretely was a group called the Theosophical Society, founded by Helena Blavatsky and Alcott in New York in the 1870s. And the Theosophical Society becomes this huge bridge between Europe and Asia. And what, they eventually moved to India, but they relocate gurus from India. They were part of this early, like, Orientalism in a romanticizing a vein. And so, they, you know, if you want to know why people talk about auras and reincarnation and practice yoga in the United States, or even all things New Age religion, all of that comes from the Theosophical Society, which was then this huge, massive movement and produced an interchange between Europe and particularly Western Asia, particularly India and Kashmir, et cetera, in and around the end of the 19th century, and then left a huge legacy. Even though the Theosophical Society basically burned out itself, all these things contributed to that background. And so to this, you know, all these different kinds of magical occult or spiritualist revivals.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
I think of theosophy as being sort of this dark river that ends up, you know, supplying fountains of weird thought all over the world, but many of those people don't even know where the water's coming from. It's still there, but it's yet, I mean, the Theosophical Society is, you know, I don't think it's been in the sort of unified way. Even early on, it was pretty split, but I mean, it just doesn't have the footprint it does physically. Yeah. But it certainly never stopped influencing things. So really, that actually leads into my next question, which is that one of the things Blavatsky got into was Bulwer Lytton and his book, The Coming Race. And frequently on our show, we talk about this interplay between fiction, explicitly intended fiction, and people who pick up the ideas from fiction and then claim that they're true. And I mean, that could go all the way to Plato and Atlantis, if you want to, you know, see it that way. But I guess my question is, how do you think the concept of disenchantment has influenced creative works? Like, I think of Star Trek, where advanced beings and their powers are depicted in ways that demystifies their magical abilities.
So I do think disenchantment, the narrative of disenchantment and the notions of reenchantment have often been worked through the aesthetic. So, well, two couple things you said that actually I also want to underscore that I agree with. I think that there's been a long interchange between fiction and, let's say, popular belief in one way or another. And that's true, as far back as Plato, that's true, not just in a European context. And one of my other hats, you know, so I'm a historian both of Western Europe and of Japan in the same time period. And, you know, we can also see similar patterns in Asia where explicit, you know, things that were written as novels become influential in the canonization of popular what we could call religious figures. Or, you know, so this interchange is And we have influence the other way, too. We have, you know, people writing religious novels, obviously, or occult novels or whatever. So and I think that the second point, the question of disenchantment and how it relates to fiction is that it often folks are able to think of their fictional world as a space of generative play where they don't have to commit to believing the things that they're portraying. Right. And because of that, there's often a real creativity in the world of fiction. Sometimes people use it to reflect inner beliefs that they actually hold. And like, you know, Alan Moore, for instance, who's a basically there was once a byline in a show that was like a mall Santa wizard or something. Anyway, he's like a, you know, he's a hilarious guy, but he, you know, wrote these really influential comic books that became things, you know, V for Vendetta is probably the one that's famous because it was turned into a movie. But, you know, he's a Western esotericism practitioner. So you have it that way, but you also have the influence of people who are not taking their, don't mean their material to be taken seriously. And that becomes, you know, Jediism, for instance, which became a religion, although I don't know how much of a tongue-in-cheek one, but I had a student do some ethnographic fieldwork before the pandemic with some Jedi, actually in Australia, members of the Jediism movement. And they claim to be serious about it, although they didn't think that they were real Jedi. I mean, they claim to be real Jedis, and they treated the Star Wars stuff as scripture, but they knew it was made up also. So there was like a line there that I was trying to get my student to figure out the nuance level of it, you know, like
right.
What... But the other piece, though, that you said that I might have disagreed with slightly, Blake, is that that there are the question about whether something is explaining something away or not. Is it probably, you know, so for instance, to take a step back, a lot of sci-fi throws in psychic powers.
They sure do.
Right? and whether psychic powers are to be thought of as enchanting or disenchanting really depends. It's very contextual. If what you're saying is, you know, the spells don't work, it's really psychic powers, that's one thing. But, you know, the line between those is more complicated, especially because many of the ways that people previously conceived of magic in the early modern era are much more contiguous with notions of psychic powers, some of them anyway. You know, if you look at, you know, Iamblichus, for instance, all the way back, in the whatever it is, 4th century, what he's talking about seemed to sound a lot like clairvoyance or something like that. It's a kind of that not to give it any more validity, but just to say that people are have long been preoccupied with certain things like the ability to see at a distance when they're not present or move things with their mind or what have you. It's no wonder that, you know, the very similar things appear in a lot of different contexts, whether they're in science fiction novels or in magical texts or in, you know, or whatever, with varying degrees of commitment. People might be saying, you know, oh, I don't know if I believe in it, but, you know, I'm just putting it in my novel. Or they might be saying, I do believe in it, but I don't want to admit to it, so I'm putting it in my novel. And then the other wrinkle is that even the category of belief, and when I say this to folks, sometimes it takes them a second, but even the category of belief we can historicize. And it may not even be the best way to describe these kind of phenomena. For instance, we tend to think of belief in the contemporary American context, for instance, as a matter of declarativity and of a kind of certainty or a binary certainty. You either believe in something or you don't. Maybe if you're a philosopher like me, because that's my other hat, you might be more used to Bayesian reasoning and percentages of belief or what have you. But actually, there's a disconnect between what people declarative belief and what people's pragmatic behavior.
Yes.
So for instance, when I tell students, do you believe in, or ask students, do you believe in talismans? Almost all of them say no. Then I say, do you have any lucky charms or any things that you always have before your sports team plays?
They're magically
and then
delicious.
They shamelessly raise their hands right up again. Yeah, magically delicious. Right. So, you know, then they raise their hands and then they have these charms that they don't believe in, but that they also use in practice.
Or yes.
Generally, there's work on the psychology of magic. You know, if you write I've done a version of this. I didn't invent it, but as an experiment with my undergraduates, you take two bottles and you have the students pick one and write poison on it. And then you ask them to pick which bottle to drink from. Almost all the students, given a free choice, will pick to drink out of the bottle that does not have the word poison written on it, even though they themselves were the ones who wrote the word poison and they know that both bottles contain water. So, you know, so there's psychological reasons that even though people say, oh, I don't believe in magic, but they act in a certain way. And this is also true in ethnographic work. When there's a famous book by a French anthropologist, Jean Favresada, I think it was translated in English as Deadly Words, about witchcraft belief in the south of France in the 70s. And she would often say, people would say, you know, to her over and over again, I don't believe in witches, but, and then they would talk about the random thing that they did to keep witches at bay, you know? So I think this very notion of belief as something that is simple and declarative, and that it's separate from practice, is artificial. It's anachronistic, basically. Yeah,
that seems fair.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I think with Star Trek, I was thinking in terms of you know, Roddenberry was trying to be non-theistic, but he hired writers, you know, who were clearly wanting to have magical things happen, and you know, waving. Yeah. That's more of an editorial choice, I guess, saying that it's not magic, it's psionics, which is also not real. Or for that matter, how many things that, you know, people think they're doing something scientific by saying, you know, we're going to go live in colonies on Mars. I'm like, the technology's not there. There's no, you know, it's not a real possibility right now. You know, incrementally, we might eventually get there. But like to act like we're going to get there soon is absurd, you know. And so, you know, and then on the other hand, you know, wishful thinking for things that aren't possible is how we get to better futures, one might say, I think, with some confidence. But
yeah. And I'm an old Star Trek fan. You know, I enjoy it. I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to call myself a Trekkie, but I did, you know, I loved, you know, Star Trek as an early tween, especially, or, you know, teenager. And in part because of its wonderfully optimistic view of it was a utopian view, at least the early Star Trek. I'm thinking of the but both the first series and then the Next Generation Star Trek, you know, they were progressive, they were optimistic, they were future oriented. You know, there were a lot of.
I will insert this slight editorial comment that I had wanted a Star Trek future, and unfortunately, what we've ended up with is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So, not ideal.
No, I worry we're like backing into Neuromancer.
Actually,
So, I want to touch upon the idea of our Western point of view. And we often discuss a lot of these concepts from that Western point of view. But do you think that the idea of disenchantment is relevant in non-Western societies as well?
Yes, very much so. But for reasons that have to do with not necessarily, well, often colonialism, but also globalization. So, you know, in Japan, for instance, in the 19th century, this is one of the things that I wrote, you know, big part of my first book is around this rupture, basically. So Japan manages to close itself off from European contact for about 200 years, 250 years. And then the U.S. shows up with guns, with cannons in the 1850s, and we forced Japan to open itself to trade, basically. That's what we wanted. But we claimed we were, you know, making the world safe for freedom of religion, which was just a sort of an excuse to open them up to trade. But because when the U.S. arrives, it starts to promote a notion, and then other European powers follow fairly quickly with Russia and France and Great Britain. One of the things that the U.S. promotes is a notion of cultural superiority as a product of technological superiority, which was also associated with, at that time, both Christianity and science. Those were the two things that the West thought it was providing. And they brought with them this notion that they represented a kind of temporality, modernity, and that anything that resisted modernity or modernization would be destroyed. And so Japanese thinkers had to figure out, well, first of all, what is this word religion? What does it mean? What is this word science? What does that mean? And but then also, what is modernity? What are these obstacles that you're describing that are supposed to be obstacles of modernity? And so the Japanese government tried to put various policies in place to strip indigenous, quote unquote, superstitions, the Japanese is meishin, away. So they tried to produce a kind of disenchantment by fiat. And the thing is, it just totally didn't work. So they would circulate texts that said, you know, there's no such thing as spirit foxes. And then, you know, they would get a letter from some guy in a province who said, look, you've told us that there's no such thing as spirit foxes, but my aunt is possessed by a spirit fox, and I want you to tell me what you're going to do about it. You can't talk them into non-existence. And then also fairly quickly, Japanese intellectuals in the same period saw spiritualism and ghosts and table turning. And so they said, wait. What is it that we're supposed to believe? What are the boundaries? Like you're saying, okay, we can agree with you that Tengu, winged goblins, are probably not a real thing, but maybe ghosts are, and maybe spirits are. And so what it actually did was it collapsed or assimilated a whole bunch of indigenous categories into one globalizing notion of spirits or ghosts. So in the end, it didn't have the effect of even a country that was very explicitly attempting to modernize by disenchanting. It reconfigured the belief landscape, but it didn't produce the kind of homogenization that, you know, one might imagine. So, but it definitely was something that, and to be sure, there were turns toward different kinds of thinking in Japan in earlier periods. There was, for instance, in the 17th century, and I've also written about this, but Kaozhong movement, that they're imported from China, but it's a verification knowledge movement. What they're trying to figure out is, you know, like it's a kind of empiricism. It's an early empiricism, and it's associated with independent interest in astronomy and independent interest in historical texts, figuring out what are actually, you know, textual forgeries that have been that have, you know, are using vocabularies that are anachronistic and all this stuff. So there's this huge already turn, and this happens basically in the 17th century toward textualism or empiricism, and that happens fairly independently of Europe. And so, but it doesn't necessarily have as its focus either A, transforming popular belief because they didn't have a similar kind of public education system, and B, it has a different ontology behind it. So the kinds of entities that they thought that they had empirical evidence for gods, for instance. And so, you know, there's similarities and differences between it and other kinds of projects. So all that is to say, you know, people are kind of, you know, we have different sources of epistemic authority. We have different worldviews, perhaps, although I don't like that term because it assumes that they're systematic, or we have different kinds of entities that we think exist, but we're not there. And there's also a fairly good psychological evidence for this. We're no more or less rational, but also educational system is often about training to people to be as rational as possible. And as somebody, you know, who teaches courses or to teach people to think at least critically, as somebody who teaches, you know, courses that are on critical thinking in both in terms of history and in terms of philosophy, you know, that doesn't come naturally. That's something that you have to learn and practice and study and, you know, learn to apply in your life. And even then, people only tend to apply it selectively. They can be very critical in some area, and then in some other area, they're, you know, they just believe, you know, any old thing. And, you know, it's
blind spots, yeah.
We talk about critical thinking and rationality and all this sort of thing as modes of evaluation, but sometimes it's not about figuring out which thing is necessarily true or not. The ideas themselves are more complicated than that, and it's about figuring out what you accept out of it and what you don't and what you, you know, that sort of thing. And these skills I still see as a technology, not a natural way of thinking. Like, I think one of the things that underlined a lot of the ideas in your book as I was reading it was the sort of realization that I came to a few years ago that critical thinking and skepticism and that sort of thing are never going to be the dominant paradigm of thought because it's not a natural way of thinking. We're not born, you know, critically analyzing everything. We're born sort of accepting the structures of belief within our families, within our communities. And, you know, you'll have dissidents, but it sometimes it's just oppositional, not necessarily based on real cogent argument. So it's complicated.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, that you know, and I know that this podcast has a historical connection to skepticism movement and what have you. And I would agree with you that, learning to think skeptically is hard work, and that people often follow the norms of their epistemic communities. So if in your community you think that, you know, some particular thing counts as, you know, for instance, in a Christian community that the Bible is the word of God, then you're going to make your thinking based on that presupposition or something like that.
Yeah.
And the people around you are going to reinforce that. And so, you know, so we're even as scientists or historians, we have various kinds of epistemic norms. And I think hopefully we work on thinking about our epistemic norms and coming to good ones, but we're often making judgments about the soundness of a particular, you know, historical archive or a particular claim. And most of the other piece of it, too, is that a lot of our thinking is not based on, you know, we're not Descartes reasoning from first principles, nor are we, you know, some Locke doing, you know, or Boyle doing firsthand experimentation. A lot of what we're doing is evaluating evidence or testimony provided to us by other people whose status or authority we are evaluating, whose reliability or trust we're evaluating. So, you know, if you want to, when I ask my students, you know, why they think, I don't know, it could be any scientific claim, you know, that the Earth goes around the sun, you know, have you firsthand evidence, or did you get it from, you know, often it turns out to be, because science, they learned it in a science class, and it fits their set of experiences, you know, and that's probably pretty good. But you can see then why when trust begins to break down in a society, people then start to look for different kinds of epistemic authorities that are not institutional, and that they can, and that can help them, and their beliefs tend to get weirder, right? So, you know, like as we saw in the pandemic, where people shifted from often from thinking of the medical establishment as authorities toward, you know, whatever, you know, YouTube influencers were out there. I mean, sorry to be critical, spouting whatever kind of nonsense about COVID or whatever. But so for that, and you can see why, because it's a question of trust more than it is often a question of evaluating evidence.
Yes.
So,
yeah, absolutely. Now, a little off topic, but we noticed that you have an upcoming volume about theosophy coming out. So can you talk about that project, or is it still under construction?
Yeah, no, it's actually out. It'll be out next month. It's a co-edited book with a colleague at Harvard. I actually have a visiting gig at Harvard this semester, actually. We're finishing. We just finished up the book.
Nice.
But it's Theosophy and the Study of Religion. And it basically emerged from two things. Basically, my co-author, who's the director of the Center for the Study of World Religions at Harvard, you know, when he became the director of that center, he was looking back through the history of that center and discovered that they had been established basically by a big anonymous donation, but he discovered it was really from theosophists.
Wow.
And so then he was like, that's weird. And then I had already written the myth book, which was in a way about how theosophists and other kinds of folks had an outsized influence on, you know, a bunch of academic disciplines, basically. And so then he organized, and then I participated in a big conference where we had people look at the history of theosophical influence and other, mostly theosophy, but some other occult influences on scholars in the history of the study of religion in particular, and looked at a certain kind of interchange. Because it turns out that there's a whole vocabulary in religious studies that we'd been inheriting from theosophy, often without noticing it. The discipline had, it turns out, and I did more archival work on this, Harvard wasn't the only program that was funded by theosophists. A lot of programs in the study of world religion, you know, studying India or Asia or whatever, turned out to have been funded by theosophists, and this is a global pattern. Mm. And then, interestingly, not just in the West. So there are Japanese scholars, D.T. Suzuki, who famously wrote books about Zen that influenced the Beats, was brought over by theosophists. This excavating this history, you know, I think it's an important, let's say, cultural background or religious background to the history of the discipline of religious studies, which was also born in the end of the 19th century, like many of the humanities and social sciences. And so it turns out that the fact that theosophy, occultism, and spiritualism were so huge in the 19th century, also the 19th century is when we get the humanities and social sciences, or what I call in the other book, the human sciences. And there's no accident that these early movements were often entangled or affected by these big cultural trends. Yeah,
I look forward to checking it out, which I probably will literally have to check it out because it's $200.
It's a brill thing. Like most of my, nobody wants to publish edited volumes anymore, and I totally get it. It's brill. So you'll have to, check it out. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. No, it sounds like another great book. And unfortunately, we're going to have to start to wrap things up. But we're definitely going to have to invite you back on the show, Jason, particularly so we can maybe talk about Japanese beliefs. That sounds really interesting. But just after discussing all of these deep topics, we've got a fun question. It's our little signature end of interview question. And we'd like to ask you, what's your favorite monster?
Mm. Yeah. Well, so if you'd asked me as a teen, I would have said vampires because I'm an aging goth, which is just something. But actually today I would say that the homunculus. Has anybody talked about this on your show? So
We have. Yes. We had an episode.
It has the title that I am the most proud of ever. Onan the Jar Burying.
That's a good full pun. What I like about them is that for those listeners who missed that episode of your podcast, so the homunculus is it's something that sounds incredibly crazy when you first hear it, but then basically starting in the 16th century, and there's a particular work attributed to Paracelsus that he probably didn't actually write, but De Natura Rerum describes a kind of process of producing an artificial human in a test tube, basically. I don't know if I should provide any of the biological details or not.
It's all there in our previous coverage. I could put a link in the show notes.
but it sounds totally crazy that you could
you could add a stroke, make a new form of life.
Add a stroke, make a new form of life. And it sounds totally crazy, but it makes sense in terms of the Aristotelian biology of the period, because they thought that fathers provided the blueprint or essence for their offspring. This is pretty sexist, but mothers only contributed to material substrate or physical base. So they thought, okay, if that's true, and if you also have the capacity to produce spontaneous generation, which is also in Aristotle, you know, the idea that basically sometimes you leave a cow alone and it creates bees. That was a common example.
Yeah.
Then of course, you could leave something in a jar with some other kind of weird matter and produce an analog to a human being. And it later even got more investment in the belief in homunculi with the notion of preformationism, which is this idea that the completely formed individual is located in the sperm, and that if you go back all the way to Adam, had an infinity of sperms, basically, and that all human beings were located in that particular gonad or whatever. And it's interesting to me both because it's something that sounds really crazy, but also kind of made sense in the context of their science. But it's also kind
at
of a
science
at the time, right? At the time, only at the time. But it has all these interesting things that have to do with their gender things built into it, around obsessions around men, around what is procreation and the boundaries of the procreative. Mm-hmm. It also has presuppositions about matter. And then finally, what's interesting to me is changing notions of heredity and generation. And I mentioned this because the Theosophy book's on its way out, but I have another book out for peer review, which is called The Genealogy of Genealogy, which is in a certain way a history of the idea of genealogy and alongside it notions of inheritance, which have changed. I won't get into more detail because it's not so related to monsters, but you know, the changing notions of heritability and inheritance have been really huge and lead toward various mistaken notions, including racialization, but also including changing ideas about procreation and how that works. And a lot of that can be historicized, and a lot of our beliefs around it, you know, in the era pre-human genome, for instance, were way weirder than most people know, for instance. So anyway, I'll end that. With the homunculi.
Fantastic. No, that's great.
Great answer. First time we've had that as an answer.
I believe that's true. Yeah. Even from the guy who came to talk about homunculi. So I think.
Yeah.
It's very, very cool. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today and to our listeners.
Thank you.
This really appreciate it.
Really, really interesting. Yeah.
So thanks for doing the work you do. Thanks for taking time to talk to us. And we do hope to have you back in the future. Listeners, check the show notes for links to all his stuff.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Jason Ananda Josephson-Storm discussing the book, The Myth of Disenchantment. Check the show notes for links to that and other works from him that may be of interest. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. Without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you for letting us be a part of your day.
This has been a Monster House presentation.